Most of you have probably been maybe sort of semi-saturated already with it, but nevertheless, I would like to perhaps review some of these things and point out maybe a few other aspects to the particular problem. I'm sure you're all here are aware of the problem, but rather interestingly enough, a survey was made in the United States a few years back wondering how many people actually considered population as a serious problem. And it was amazing how very few people sitting back in their comfortable houses actually thought of population as a problem. But let me present now some of the aspects of it. First off, 5,600 people increase in the world every hour. 5,600 people, 1 hour. Before we're through speaking this afternoon, you can figure out how many new people. It took 8,000 years to bring the population to 1 billion. Then only 100 years to double it to 2 billion. Then 45 years to bring it to 3 billion. And probably it will be 30 years or less from now to bring the population to maybe 6 billion. The present doubling time of the population is something around 35 years. Okay, we've been mentioning figures, billions, I don't know, I can't conceive of a billion people, much less 3.5 billion people. Probably you can't either. And doubling, okay, you know, 1, 2, 4, so what? Rather, to bring this to point exactly what we mean by doubling, incidentally, this is a cancer, very similar to a cancerous type of growth, which I'll mention a bit. But let me make a little analogy here. Supposing you were able to talk an employer into giving you 1 cent the first day of working, 2 cents the next day, 4 cents the third day, and then do this for a month. You know, how about it? You think you could do it? If you could, rather interestingly enough, the 15th day you would be earning more than $160. For the 25th day, $167,000. And by the end of the month, you would have earned more than $10 million. That's by simple doubling for 1 month. Another analogy we could make using a chessboard. Supposing we were to place a single grain of rice on the first square of a chessboard, 2 grains on the second, and so on, 2, 4, 8. How much rice would you need? Quite a bit. Several thousand times the world's annual rice crop. So now you see what doubling is. Rather insignificant when you have few figures, but sizable when you're up in the millions and billions, and we're 3.5 billion now. 7 billion in 35 years. 14 billion. Okay. What about cancer? It's the same type of a thing. Cancer is a condition in which cells do not mature, they continue to divide. They remain in this dividing state. If you have one cancer cell, it divides, you have two. Maybe they divide once a week, once a month. Nevertheless, 2 cancer cells, 4, 8, 16, 32, 3.5 billion, 7 billion. Pretty soon it's sizable, then it's too late. Supposing the human population were to go for 1,000 years, 1 billion billion people, those are vast numbers. How much is 1 billion billion? If we were to take all of the Earth's surface, land, and sea, how many people would 1 billion billion people? Well, can you picture this blackboard? 1,700 people in that area of blackboard. Well, how are you going to do it? That's a good question. Rather interesting report was made by Fremlin, 1964. He's a physicist, in which he has hypothesized what would happen if there were supposedly nothing to stop this continued doubling of the population. In other words, if we do not consciously limit the population, or if perhaps famine, pestilence, and disease, war, and other things did not limit, obviously there's going to be a limit to the population. You've got to face this. What is the limit? Supposing now we had all of the technological information at hand that we could solve all of these technological problems, and nothing is too great for us. Supposing this were the case, he divides it up into a series of stages that could theoretically maybe be reached, supposing there were no other limitations. Okay, first stage one, in 260 years, this would be seven doublings, which would give us 400,000 million people. You can imagine that. But what about the world if this were to ever be accomplished? He said, if we were to use the existing methods of agriculture, and supposing, we could bring it up to the maximum food production, everything. But to do this, we would have to eliminate eating meat, and we'd have to eliminate all wildlife, because if you remember this morning, I mentioned the food chain and this pyramidal structure. The base of the chain is photosynthetic, the plankton or the photosynthetic organisms. To get the maximum food, you've got to utilize that. You've got to cut out the meat-eating animals. They're just too wasteful as far as that's concerned. So it would eliminate meat-eating, all wildlife. We'd have to harvest all the seafood, and as to have sufficient space for agriculture and everything, he proposes an agricultural roof over cities and roads. This would be 260 years of this. Okay, stage two, 370 years, 3 million. Again, a large figure I can't even conceive of. In this case, then, we would have, supposing now we could possibly find organisms that could give us the maximum efficiency as far as photosynthesis is concerned. This would be 8% of the total solar radiation. These would potentially be in the sea. If we could find these organisms, utilize them, then conceivably we could double the population again three more times. Of course, again, we'd have to remove all wildlife of the seas and grow only this one organism at optimum conditions. Okay, stage three, 450 years from now, 15 million. In this case, we have to go to something else other than solar energy for photosynthesis, or use some artificial means. Well, he suggests uranium and thorium fission. However, this, because of the problems involved, would not be too much additional help to actually double the population again. Then he suggests the only other possibility would be using satellite reflectors in orbit to increase the sunlight so that you would have sun on the dark side of the Earth, and also give more sunlight to the poles so you could utilize this. And what about the satellite reflectors? 100 million square kilometers of mirror and 30 million tons, no small job, and we'd have to get that out in orbit. But supposing we could do this, might be possible. Few little details, however. If the CO2 problem doesn't do it, this will melt the polar ice, and then you've got a little less space to live on. That's a problem here. And overheating is definitely would be a problem, because you don't have the darkness to cool off. Then stage four, he brings up to 680 years with 1,000 million people. And this way, we've got to do something else other than photosynthesis. So here we directly synthesize the foods, carbohydrates and otherwise, and have to utilize waste products completely. This would be cadavers and everything. Everything has got to be completely utilized. Then we would have supposedly 680 years. Then the next stage would be up to 800 years. This would be 2 people per square meter. And at this point, serious refrigeration problems. People create heat and otherwise, and how are we going to get rid of the excess heat? He suggests using the oceans to remove heat. And if this were so, then the oceans would rise 1 degree centigrade each year. Well, in 800 years, the oceans would be converted to steam. So that doesn't sound too palatable either. Stage 5, this is the ultimate limit now, 890 years, plus or minus, I guess, a few years. And the number of people then, 60,000 million. And in this case, he said, he sort of came to the conclusion that the previous method of using the oceans to cool the place off isn't going to work, so we got to try something else. So we roof in the ocean, you know, put a big roof over everything, and we pump the heat to the outside of this roof. Well, considering all the laws of thermodynamics, not being troubled with where we're going to get the energy and all this and that, we've got all this technical knowledge. You see, with all these number of people, you must have an awful lot of Shakespeare's and Einstein's floating around. So that probably no problem at all. And considering this, we would end up then with 120 persons per square meter. And this outer skin that we have on the surface of the Earth would have a temperature of 1,000 degrees centigrade. And he feels that raising much higher than this, I don't know even how he reaches this point, would seem formidable. And what are we going to do? You know, all these number of people on an area no larger than the blackboard. Well, he proposes then a continuous 2,000-story building over the land and sea in which the people would live in 1,000 stories and the rest would just be operation, maintenance, and so on and so forth. Well, here then, in other words, okay, we've reached the heat limit. There are a certain number of people that supposing we had all the maximum know-how and otherwise, there is a limit, even if there were no biological limit, which we're going to discuss in a bit. But 2 important questions to consider. First, do you want to live this way? And 2, could we live this way? In other words, could we biologically, could you conceive of living this way, could we, or will we reach other limitations? In conclusion, I'd like to bring out 2 things. There are, the way I look at it, there are 2 alternatives. One, we either do nothing to prevent the present growth of population, or we do something to prevent it. Okay, assuming the first, that we do nothing to prevent the growth of population. In other words, we go along merely as we are now. Inevitably, it's going to be limited for us, whether we like it or not. It will be either this physical heat limitation or probably much sooner a biological limitation. In other words, tensions, war, disease, any innumerable type of possibilities. But even if this were never to occur, there will be a physical limitation. It's inevitable. If, however, we do choose to limit the population, this, in other words, assuming that we're doing this, it will be a conscious choice. It will be a conscious limitation. If this is the case, any method we use is, quote, artificial. Whether it's the rhythm method, whether it's the IUD, condom, the pill, sterilization. Any method that we use, presuming it is consciously done, it is artificial. So what do we choose? Are we going to consciously limit the population, or will we wait until it's limited for us?
just saying, if there's anyone here who feels the ultimate role of man is producing souls to fill the choirs of heaven, I suggest they leave now because I don't have anything to say to you. The other thing that Paul Ehrlich says, if your solution to the population problem reads something like this, quote, in 1975, a spaceship arrived from planet X to start exporting the surplus human population to another solar system. If this is your solution, I don't have anything to say to you either. So I ask those people to leave now. This issue of population is the one, as far as the environment is concerned, that separates the men from the boys. Let me illustrate. Now, a lot of politicians have jumped on this bandwagon, but there are very few politicians that will risk their political neck by coming out and saying anything about population limitation for two reasons. Well, probably more, but two reasons as I see it. One is, first of all, they will offend a certain element of the voting public. Another one is that population regulation goes against the cowboy growth philosophy in this country. In other words, big business generally feels that in order, well, generally they feel babies are good for business. We have to continue to grow in order for business to continue to prosper. And this is why most politicians avoid this issue. If you talk to them privately, you may get a different view. But in public, they are very reluctant to speak out. There are a couple of exceptions. Gaylord Nelson, and since we've spent the summer in Oregon, I shout hooray for Bob Packwood. He has the courage of his convictions, anyway. But I have, or I suspect from what I gather, the forces of opposition are gathering, and I very much doubt if Packwood is reelected, because people don't like to think in terms of family limitation. But this, we need more Gaylord Nelsons and Robert Packwoods. So if some of you are going in or interested in the political field, it takes people with courage to maybe think in terms of one term, but I think we need more people like this. Well, as I say, I definitely feel that this is number one in terms of approaching the environment. This morning I talked about attitudes, but population cannot be overlooked either. And again, this is part of an attitude. But one thing I discovered quite quickly, you don't go out into the grassroots and start telling people to limit their families, because you step on people's toes right away and you lose your audience, and you lose any sympathy that they may have had for the problem. So you've got to step a little bit gingerly on this topic. In a number of instances, I've overreacted. Now let me just illustrate. My wife is involved in Girl Scouts, Brownie program, and her assistant leader had two children. Let's just say they're 9 or 9 and 10. I'm not sure their ages. But then number three comes along, accidentally or otherwise, I'm not sure. And she decides, or they decide, that it isn't good for this lone child to grow up by itself. So they want to have two more. You know, it's good for children to grow up with one another. Well, about the time that we were aware of the fact that she was pregnant, I became interested in ZPG, and I picked up one of these stickers, these bumper stickers. You know, the population bomb is everyone's baby. I don't know if you've seen that or not. But then the wife took the car to scout meeting, and Sharon saw the bumper sticker, and she was very much offended. I'm not sure she has recovered yet. So we have to be a little bit careful here. Another case where I overreacted, but I guess it really didn't do much damage. Again, I was one evening I talked to a group at the church on this topic, And I'd hit population control quite heavily. And I was somewhat encouraged when I went home. I thought maybe I'd gotten the message across. I have the habit of, before I turn in for the evening, I turn on the 10 o'clock news. And I take it news TV stations are somewhat, have a scarcity of material on Sunday evening. At least this must have been the case. Because I turned on the TV, as I say, I was feeling quite optimistic in terms of the environment. And what should they have but a 3-minute short, this is Iowa now, on a lady in Cedar Rapids who had, oh Lord, 16 or 17 children. And here they were, this was just shortly after Environment Day. And here they were painting, it seemed to me, a rosy picture, you know, how great this was, how good it was for children to grow up together in an atmosphere like this. And I just bristled. I had to take my audiovisual equipment back up to school. And I knew there was no sense in my going to turning in that night because I wouldn't sleep anyway. So I sat down at my typewriter at the office and I whipped up a letter to WMT TV stations. I said a lot of things. Maybe if I'd waited till morning, I wouldn't have been quite as emotional. But essentially, what I said was that I was tired of seeing ecological obscenities on TV. And that I thought a TV station had a greater obligation to man than to try to paint a rosy picture of large families, at least at this point in history. Well, I thought that was probably the end of it. I felt a little better, although so often when I get excited about something like this, I think I did spend a rather sleepless night. But anyhow, about 2 days later, I received a personal letter from the president of WMT TV, and I wonder what size family he had, because you get the same argument. Essentially, he said we don't have a problem in this country, at least to the extent that he felt TV stations had to consider the validity of their reporting. He says news is news; it will report it without too much thought to the effects it may have on people. I'd also asked him for equal time for ZPG or Planned Parenthood, but he didn't come forth with any offers. But that was, I guess I did reply to his letter. One thing he jumped on was my criticizing this lady, and I didn't intend this at all, because after all, that situation we can't really do anything about. So I did reply to his letter, but I guess the point I'm trying to make is this is a sensitive issue, and you have to be a little bit careful. So before I start, we have visited with a few people here, and I am impressed with some of the sizes of families. And again, it is rather difficult for me to talk on this subject because I have too many children also. I have three. So if you think I'm being critical, keep in mind that I'm criticizing myself as well. And the thing about it is I feel that I am part of the problem. Maybe I ought to in some way be part of the solution, as someone has said. I can't recall right off hand. Well, anyhow, so the thing I want to do first is talk to the people who have larger families than two, such as I do. And perhaps some of you are from large families and you think, gee, that environment that I grew up in was just great. It's just great to be in a large family. So I want to talk to you people first of all, so that you don't start throwing rotten eggs or tomatoes at me before I get done. First of all, obviously we can't change the fact that large families are with us. We simply have to accept that. But the point is, we have to stop. If you have eight children, stop. Let's not have 9 or 10. If you have 5 girls, as I have 3 girls, and you would sure like a boy, I don't really think that having 3 girls is a reason to try to have a boy. The probability is still 50-50, as I have to every year convince my genetics classes of this. The other thing is, Well, I've got several things to hit on this point because, as I say, I've had trouble with it before. Secondly, you have to love the children you have. Now, I may not be proud of the fact at this particular point in history that I have three children, but I love my children. I'm proud of them. I think this has to go along with it. Those of us with large families have a special obligation to ensure that our children don't fall into the same cycle. So maybe it would behoove you to support ZPG. ZPG, by the way, is Paul Ehrlich's organization, Zero Population Growth, and they advocate, public relations, advertising, and this sort of thing to encourage smaller families. Or perhaps you should support Planned Parenthood. Again, trying to ensure a better, or at least as good a life for your children. Fourth thing that I think you have to do is, and this is rather hard, you have to tell your children to do as I say, not as I did. In other words, I hate to use the term indoctrination, but let's say teach your children the importance of a maximum of two children when they go to plan their families. Two has to be the absolute limit, I think, in just in practical terms. Fifth, don't make a point of bragging about your family size. I mean, you can brag about children, but don't brag on that point. And finally, later on, if your children decide not to have a family, or if they decide they will have only two children and they happen to be all girls, don't fuss at them because they don't have a boy. In other words, leave well enough alone, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Well, so much for that. I just wanted to get that out of the way first because I have run into trouble on this point before. So I want you to be aware of the fact that I feel I'm also part of the problem, and I don't want to be hypocritical about this thing. Okay, this afternoon then, I want to stick a little more to biology rather than philosophical implications of environment, as I tried to hit on this morning. I want to look at what I call some parables from animal populations. You know, the old argument, and Mrs. Collins got at this, regulation of human populations is simply unnatural. Now, I would say people that adhere to this philosophy, when they talk about the unnaturalness of regulating populations, don't know much about biology, because population regulation is a intrinsic fact in practically every population. Now, there are various mechanisms that animal populations use to regulate their numbers. Some of these, from a human standpoint, are better than others, but needless to say, animal populations are regulated. Now, first of all, I want to mention what we call the extrinsic factors of population regulation. Now, the first of these was proposed or came to the fore by Malthus, who, of course, was an economist, and he stressed the importance of food supply. So this is one. Food supply regulates populations. There are others. Predation. Physical factors, such as weather and climate, limit animal numbers. And then finally, diseases and parasites limit animal numbers. Now, some examples of populations that are regulated by these mechanisms, I could list several, but just for example, lemmings, you've heard of these, snowshoe hare, Canada lynx, this is a type of a mechanism. Deer populations essentially depend on the availability of food, and most of the smaller organisms, microorganisms, are regulated by mainly food supply or sometimes physical factors. Now, but this isn't the end result or the end as far as nature is concerned for mechanisms of population regulation. There are other hypotheses that we can look to. Now, I don't want to get bogged down here, but maybe I can move along a little rapidly. Now, there is one that is called the Wynne-Edwards hypothesis of population regulation, and there's good evidence for this. Let me move away from the loud. Okay. Wynne-Edwards has made the observation, as many people have, that in many bird populations, particularly nesting populations of seabirds, there is a beautiful correlation between the availability of food supply and the population. That is, you very seldom see a seabird population outstripping its food supply. And this has led many people to wonder what mechanisms are involved in this regulation. Well, when they look at it, they find that there are three. And these are, by and large, behavioral mechanisms. The first of these involves territorial systems. And this simply states, in most cases where you find these colonies, there is a limited amount of territory for nesting. And each bird requires a certain amount of space in order to nest successfully. Once the space is taken up, the population surplus is shoved to the outside, and these individuals on the outside do not reproduce. Hence, you have a relatively stable population. So territorial systems are one such mechanism. Just a little sidelight here, territorial mechanisms are important on land as well. Most of us enjoy bird songs in the spring. They're particularly beautiful in the spring. And the reason for this is not for man's delight, although this is a nice side effect. The reason for it is that bird is announcing or trying to lay claim to a territory, and he does this by singing. So the song isn't even intended for the female. It's intended for other males, and he's saying, "This is my territory, boy, you stay out." And it's usually the stronger, the more fit individuals that succeed in winning a mating territory. Well, the second way in which birds regulate their population is closely related to territory, but instead of involving a definite amount of nesting space, it involves an actual nest. So that, again, in seabirds, we will find in some species there are there is a limited space. There are given nests, and the same birds return to the same nest each year. And again, once the nests are occupied, everybody that's left over doesn't get to reproduce. Again, they're shoved to the outside, and tough luck, buddy. Better luck next time. But again, the effect is to keep the population constant. The third mechanism in birds is the so-called pecking order. And I think you're familiar with this if you've ever watched barnyard chickens. Usually in any group of birds, there is a dominant individual and on down the line to the lowest people on the totem pole. And it's usually only the individuals that are up here, which again are usually more biologically fit, that are capable of, capable of holding their position in the pecking order. Those down here on the lower end usually do not compete successfully for mates and do not mate. So essentially, again, a pecking order is a mechanism of regulating or retaining population size. Now, these, you will say, are beautiful mechanisms. They don't involve starvation. They don't involve any violence. And say this, by the way, is interesting. By and large, animal populations are fairly free of violence. Man is about the only species, although there are a few exceptions. Man is one of the few species that uses violence against members of his own species. Other animals have, through the process of evolution, worked in such a way that violence is avoided, so that this struggle that goes on in bird colonies usually involves bluffing, displays, stereotype types of behavior. Very seldom is any bloodshed in competing for territory. Well, you may wonder, as I say, these are neat mechanisms for regulating population size. Why hasn't man developed mechanisms such as this? And the answer here is that man probably did, but they have been lost within historic times. As if we go back in the ancient history of man, certainly he must have had some means similar to these of regulating populations. There is no evidence to indicate to the contrary, for example, that Paleolithic hunters ever had any population problems. As I say, though, maybe this is rather difficult to get at, but at least we don't have any evidence. Hence, we suspect that primitive man did have means of population regulation. And actually, if we look at Stone Age cultures that are with us today, we do see means of regulating population numbers. Now, the mechanisms that are used in these primitive cultures today, from our moral standpoint, are not particularly good, but the objective they achieve in terms of a stable population for the environment, it may make the mechanism justified. Now, these in general are four, and I'll simply list these. Infanticide, a lot of tribes regulate their numbers by killing excess babies. Now, this is, of course, repugnant to us. A second one is abortion. A third one is abstinence from intercourse. And a fourth one will occur in those societies in which you have a patriarch or a very strong chief that everyone listens to what he says. In some of these tribes, the chief will simply say, well, you and you and you will not marry and have children. And everybody goes along with it, you see. So these are mechanisms that we have found in primitive tribes. An interesting sidelight here, I might mention, and I'm sure some of you are probably aware of it. One individual that has had an effect on my life, probably more so than any other, is my major professor at Iowa State, who happens to be a Mennonite. Well, anyhow, he had a brother who was a missionary to South America and was working with one of these primitive tribes. And of course, when the Mennonites went in and saw the practice of infanticide, killing babies, this was, of course, the first thing that they wanted to stop, and justifiably so. But, you see, these tribes were living in kind of a gathering, hunting type of culture. In a culture like this, the ratio should be about one person per 5 acres. And it was just a very short amount of time before people were starting to starve to death. So then, of course, they had to introduce improved methods of agriculture. They had to change the society from a gathering, hunting type of culture to an agricultural society. This may or may not have been good. But here again, the land wasn't adapted to modern agriculture. So essentially, they again were limited on the amount of, or the size of the population they could control. So eventually, I think, as I see the end of the story, the Mennonites, although they may be a little reluctant to support population control in the U.S., have been brought to see the necessity of it in this particular instance in South America. Well, moving on then, the mechanisms of population control in birds then are at least not applicable to man in his present situation. There are there is one other broad study that I want to look at because I feel this one is applicable to us. Now, while I was at Iowa State University, there was a man there by the name of Paul Arrington. Some of you may have heard of him. I would guess probably most of you haven't. But anyhow, Paul Arrington was a student of Aldo Leopold, whose book, Sand County Almanac, I mentioned this morning. Paul Arrington is no longer living, by the way. Paul Arrington was, as I recall, a really didn't know him. I didn't have him as a teacher, but I recall this scene quite often in the science building, this rather weird individual sloshing around in his hip boots, walking up and down the aisles of the science building. You had a rather, in that day and age, what was a kind of a messy type of haircut. He had a rather red face. He was rather a fat, dumpy-looking individual. Certainly, if one of our staunch Iowa legislators had seen Paul Arrington, he probably would have wanted to run him out of the university. That was 10 years ago. But Paul Arrington made some real important contributions to animal populations. And as I want to say, many of these are applicable, I feel, to man. Paul Arrington also, by the way, rejected the God hypothesis. So he was not at all Christian in his outlook, nothing of the sort. He was an atheist, although not an outspoken atheist. It was rather interesting, too. At the time, of course, in my position, I was associated with the Kill 'em and Count 'em pesticide entomologist. And over in the other building, there was what the entomologist referred to as the Arrington cult. And we had some very good back and forth feedback. And again, this was 10 years before this environmental thing came out in the open. Essentially, we talked about many of the same things a lot of people are talking about today. Well, anyhow, what did Paul Arrington do? He studied two things, two populations. First of all, he was interested in bobwhite quail. He studied populations in Iowa and Wisconsin. And one outstanding thing he observed was that very seldom did the quail population ever grow beyond certain limits. In other words, it remained stable from year to year. Now, he must have tramped many miles just observing quail. While he was in Wisconsin, he had about 1,000-acre area. He knew every quail in that area, and he practically knew them by name. So he studied these intensively for 5 or 6 years. And about all he discovered was that there apparently were psychological mechanisms in the quail population that were limiting their numbers. One of the important contributions of Arrington was the concept of a threshold of security. And this is just common sense. In any animal population, you have good habitat in which the animals are fairly well adapted, fairly well protected. But as the population grows, individuals get out of this secure area, and the individuals on the periphery are picked up by predators. So this is his contribution. But the thing that was limiting quail populations, apparently, was the fact that when the population increased, these quail became so uneasy. They became so much more concerned with other individuals, the presence of other individuals in the population, that they became restless, and they tended to forget about where they were in terms of their secure little niche. And they were so concerned about this other quail next to them bothering them that the first thing you know, this individual would get out here on the edge and a predator would pick it up. So you see, it was a psychological mechanism that was kind of disturbing the quail. Okay, that was a conclusion from that population. Now, Arrington also studied muskrats, and this is why we very seldom saw him in anything but hip boots, because he was always wading around in marshes. But I feel maybe the muskrat is a more analogous type of parable to the human population. Maybe as I go along here, you'll see why. Again, Arrington observed that muskrat populations, although you would have population explosions, so to speak, they would never outstrip their food supply. In other words, the population died off before all of the food was used up. So this meant that there had to be another mechanism in the population other than simply dependence on food that was regulating the numbers. Now, again, Arrington's concept here was the idea of what we biologists refer to as shock disease. And again, this was essentially a psychological disturbance which eventually, or maybe, I guess it's hard to say which comes first here, the chicken or the egg, but You have psychological disturbance and leading to or the result of physiological changes in the body of the muskrat. Well, normally the female muskrat produces a litter of about 20. She produces 2 litters a year normally, which means that one female can produce 40 per year. Now, if the habitat will support the population, the muskrat colony is rather easy, life is good. But as the number of offspring tends to increase, the female gets rather uneasy. Something happens in her physiology. Litter size drops so that she only produces about 4. And there are other things that happen in the population. In general, it's a rather messy business. Let me quote from Harrington as he describes what happened in the muskrat population. Now, if any, I'm sure most of you read newspapers, and you should have no trouble in drawing parallels between Harrington's description of muskrats and what we read from day to day in the newspapers. Okay, let me quote. Now, this may get a little bit lengthy, but I think it's better than I could do in trying to summarize it. So we're talking about this decrease, this shakedown in the muskrat population, which essentially is what we're headed for in the human population unless we come up with a mechanism of regulation. Okay, the natural shaking down of the muskrat population to fit its habitat and its social mold may be deadly methods, even when the only deadly muskrat enemies are other muskrats. Compared with the troubles of many other species, muskrat troubles may be more savage and violent, probably because, or most certainly because, the muskrats possess murderous teeth. When matters really go wrong for the muskrats, all their nightmares come true. Okay, go on. Excess or misfit or strange adults may circulate about a marsh, finding trouble and making trouble. They may have gashes around their rumps or tails bitten through. Now, this is getting a little far-fetched, I realize. They may have bites in the kidneys, bites in the livers, intestines, or into any body parts the teeth can reach and penetrate. They may try to walk on elbows after having their forelegs hamstrung. They may have face wounds, feet swollen out of shape, and wounds that fill with maggots or provide sites for abscesses. They hobble around and sit in nests on the shore. They bleed where they go and where they rest, and now and then one dies. Strife sex victims may include huge animals of either sex at the height of physical prowess, but not able to or disposed to live in peace. They may include sick or injured or simply those too immature to take care of themselves. The animals that could not keep away from other animals that did not want them around. Some victims may be among the aggressively troublesome. Some may be only those offspring inviting targets for the abuse of their fellows. A weaned young enters its home lodge and eats the hindquarters off of a member of a newborn litter that it finds unprotected. A mother kills a couple of her own weaned young and driving them away before the birth of another litter. A mother may see a young muskrat swimming on the far side of a cleared space surrounding her lodge, swim out to it and bite it to death. Or a mother on a crowded marsh may enter a lodge containing another mother's young, kill them in the nest and lift them or take over the lodge for the housing of her own. Yes, life can be very cheap among the muskrats in an overpopulated area. The mistake should not be made of taking for granted that such troubled lives are merely the ordained lot of muskrat flesh, or that the troubles of muskrats increase in direct proportion to the numbers of muskrats. The troubles increase out of all proportion to the numbers of muskrats as populations become top-heavy in terms of what muskrats recognize as crowding. In the other direction, lowering of populations down to the level that the muskrats find socially more tolerable means proportionally less trouble. I don't know if that's said anything about the psychological effects that we are observing in human populations right now, but maybe we shouldn't underplay the psychological mechanism of population control. We've talked quite a bit about starvation and this type of thing, but I think psychological mechanisms are also important. Now, just to close here briefly, the question then arises, does this type of mechanism, as Harrington described, Does this model apply to the human population? And I would say the answer is yes, but the answer is up to us at this point in history. Now, essentially, what you have in our population or in any population is a death rate and a birth rate. Now, if these two are in equilibrium, the population is stable. Currently, we have a death rate so that our population is tending toward instability. Now, in terms of regulating numbers, you really don't have much in the way of alternatives. You can either talk in terms of a death rate solution or a birth rate solution. Now remember, I am saying you are interested in regulating human numbers. If you're not, again, I would suggest you leave. So you have the alternative. You can either go death rate solution or you can go birth rate solution. You don't have any other choice. Oh, you can say, well, we can have a green revolution. We can support more people. But really all you're doing there is maybe putting off until the next generation the decision you should have made now. And in the meantime, the environment continues to go downhill. Okay, death rate solutions. Let's look at these first. These are by and large for war. This is speaking of man now. War. And if you've read Paul Ehrlich's book, he points out war isn't a very good means of regulating numbers unless you get into a nuclear war, and then we don't worry about the environment anyway, because we're doing pretty well shot. Two, disease. Three, starvation. And this mechanism is already taking over in large areas of the world, as you're quite aware. And four, Arrington's mechanism in muskrat populations, social and psychological unrest. So those are death rate solutions. You either accept one or a combination of those. Okay, over here then we have birth rate solutions. And these, again, you're familiar with. I tried to list these in order of, benefit or success. The first of which is the oral contraceptive. And although there are certain reservations about oral contraceptives presently, I would still say the risk of an ever-burgeoning population outweigh any side effects from contraception. Now, hopefully we can come up with something better. And I have a little bit to say about this in a little bit. Two, vasectomies, in other words, sterilization of males. And whether you know it or not, most doctors are reluctant to perform these unless you already have seven or eight children and are living at the poverty level. Three is abortion. And I won't say anything about this because we'll have a panel discussion on abortion tomorrow. Four is legislation along the lines that you see Bob Packwood proposing. Fourth is the tack that Red China has taken, late marriages. Sixth is the rhythm method. I'm going to put this next to last because it's a little better than nothing. And seventh, abstinence. Oh, I forgot, and fourth, celibacy here too. It'll fall in there somewhere between the rhythm method and abstinence. So these are birth rate solutions. Now, the rub, as I see it, comes in here. And part of the problem is we have always thought in terms of regulating death rates. In other words, we have spent millions of dollars coming up with drugs to wipe out disease. We have spent millions in cancer research. We spent millions in coming up with polio vaccines. Well, you name it. You know what amounts of money have been spent in medical research, which are essentially ways of reducing death rates. Now, the medical profession and scientists, and I'm a scientist, have been somewhat remiss in not recognizing, at the same time that we are lowering death rates, that we have a moral obligation to do research on the other side of the coin, regulating birth rates. But this simply hasn't been done. This is why the pill is the only contraceptive that we have today that has seen any success. And this is why I hope that we have men of courage that see to it that funding is placed in this area of birth rate solutions. This is the only answer. So, ultimately what it boils down to, if you are opposed to oral contraceptives, if you are opposed to means such as abortion, if you are opposed to vasectomies on the basis that these are unnatural, then you are advocating a death rate solution to the human population problem. It's as simple as that. Now, you may talk glibly in terms of a green revolution and how we can feed more people at the banquet of life, but all you are doing is pushing off your responsibility onto the next generation, and you aren't saying anything about equality of existence or any of these considerations. So you take your, you pay your money, you take your choice. Either you are advocating death rate solution or birth rate solution. Okay, I guess we throw it open now for some questions.